to, oh, it works now, fantastic. Apparently the green light was what I was looking for. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right, fantastic. So my name is Greg Seppi, I'm the moderator for this panel. We're currently waiting on the staff here to correct a issue with the projector. It's not working, so we're just doing the best we can, and we'll get started as soon as we can. Was there?
Would it be worth it to get any introductions?
Yes, I might as well get introductions out of the way. So.
That's great.
Then we can hit the ground running.
Right. So first, this session is sponsored by Franklin Gilliam Rare Books, a fine rare book company. Let's see. And our first speaker today is Francesca Marini. She is an associate professor and the associate dean for special collections and the director of the Cushing Memorial Library and Archives at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. Prior to this position, she was the director of archives at the Stratford Festival in Stratford, Ontario, Canada, and the assistant professor at the School of Library, Archival, and Information Sciences, University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Her PhD is in Library Information Studies from UCLA. And she also holds a master's degree in Archival Studies, Paleography, and Diplomatics from the School of the Modena State Archives in Modena, Italy, and a bachelor's degree in Film and Theater Studies from the University of Bologna, Italy. Her main research interests focus on performing arts, archiving, and she's been engaged in several research projects. She's a University of Glasgow honorary research fellow in Arts and Humanities Data Services fellow. She presents at national and international conferences and publishes often. So our second speaker, it's a privilege to have her here today. Our second speaker is Beth M. Whitaker from the University of Kansas. And just give me a second to pull up her bio. But no less.
And we just had a scar to get the thing to arrive.
Oh, good. All right. So Beth M. Whitaker is the Assistant Dean of Distinctive Collections at the University of Kansas Libraries, where she leads Special Collections, Archives, Conservation, and International Area Studies initiatives. She has written and presented widely on a variety of topics related to special collections, cataloging, cultural heritage. She edited RBM for many years and has held various leadership positions in ACRL's, in our section, RBMS. She also is obsessed with Pokemon Go. Which is impressive. So it was a privilege to have her here as well. Hopefully you can catch them all. We should all be so lucky. So our third speaker is Chris M. Markman. She is the director of digital learning and user experiences for the Harvard Library, where she works on understanding how users interact with library services, sites, and spaces. And all three of these presentations are extremely interesting to me. All special collections, archives, maybe even libraries in general, I think we're all interested in ways to share our message better and more effectively, and exhibits are, I think, the most distinctive way we can do that. So it's going to be great once we get this projector set up and get a chance to listen to these speakers instead of me. So I should mention, my name is Greg Seppi. I'm from L. Tom Perry Special Collections at Brigham Young University. I'll be moderating this panel. I'm a curator of 19th and 20th century Americana at BYU. And it's a privilege to be here. So a quick FYI, because we've been delayed, we are going to let the session run over just a little bit. Potentially, I don't know that we'll need to. Depending on how long Q&A goes, we might run over. So feel free to leave if you need to, of course. But it looks like we're almost ready.
can hear me? Can you hear me well? No, not at all? Better? Yes, I'll stand like that. Okay, so whenever you can't hear me, just let me know and I'll adjust it. So thank you so much for coming, and thank you for your patience, and thank you to the museum staff for fixing our technical problems. As Greg said, I am Associate Dean for Special Collections at Texas A&M University, and I'm also the director of the Cushing Library, which has rare books, special collections, and archives, and I'm Associate Professor there. So today I'm just going to give you some preliminary results from a pilot study that I conducted. I'm working on a bigger study, but I started with a small pilot study working at looking at exhibition practices in special collections, archives, and rare book libraries in North America. So I have a couple examples from Canada and then other ones from the US. And I only talked to 9 institutions, so it's a small sample, but it's a qualitative study, and it's just the beginning to get to the larger study. So I'm just going to give you some an overview of the methodology and just highlights of the findings. I got some really rich data, so this is just very snippets from what I learned. So I took a qualitative approach, and my main question was how do institutions in North America, which have rare books, special collections, and archives, how do they approach exhibitions? I had several secondary research questions, which I'm not sure if you can read, but they go more into the detail of how are exhibition programs run, what are the main goals of the programs, who is the audience that they're targeting, what current trends and emerging approaches are they following? And then I also wanted to look at successes and challenges and the differences and similarities with museums. We do a lot of exhibitions at Texas A&M University, and I also have exhibition experience from when I was working at the Stratford Festival. We created a 4,000 square feet display area in the archives, and we also created an exhibition space in downtown Stratford. So personally, my career has been very involved with exhibitions, and I've always been interested in seeing how much we are similar or different from museums. And there is, of course, a lot of overlapping, so this is a theme that I hope to explore more in the larger study. So just a quick note for those of you who work in academic libraries, whenever you do a study, you have to go to the Office of Research and get clearance if you're working with human subjects or animals, not in this case. So I did check with them. They are getting a little more open in their policies. This is going across different universities. So for this study, they said that I wasn't talking about the individual personal experience of the participants. We were talking about institutions, so I didn't have to do a full clearance, and they were fine. So I still, though, put together an information sheet, and I gave a form to the institution to sign for approval, because I'm still kind of brainwashed that you need to do that. So I chose a purposeful sample, so this is not a random sample, it's not a large sample, it's purposeful, so it's based on just the criterion of having academic and non-academic institutions, and also public and private, but the main criterion is having an established exhibition program. I approached 13 institutions, and a lot of people were very busy, so I got 9 replies, and I really appreciate it because I had a really long survey. I had 73 questions, so I really appreciate all the people who participated and the time they took. So I talked to Georgia State University, their Special Collections and Archives, to the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles, the Grolier Club in New York, the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin, Santa Clara University, the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, UCLA in Los Angeles, and the Marriott Library at the University of Utah, and the Vancouver Public Library. So the majority of these are public universities. There is one public library, one religious institution, and 2 private institutions. And so the public ones, of course, are Georgia State, UBC, UCLA, Utah, and UT Austin. Santa Clara is a Jesuit university. Vancouver Public Library, of course, is public. And then I look at the Grolier Club, which all of you know, and the Getty Research Institute, which is part of the major Getty Center. So they have museums, but they also have the Research Institute there. So I have an open-ended questionnaire, so people could write in all their answers without without structure, and I had 700 sections and 73 questions. So one participant actually called the questionnaire a doozy, which was a nice way to say it was too long. So a different section, so I just collected some information about the participants and the unit, and then I collected information about the exhibition team, the exhibition program as a whole, the main topics and the kind of research that goes in each, into each exhibition. Then I wanted to know a little bit about narrative, which is very relevant to our conference here. I wanted to know about audience, all the activities around exhibitions, and then at least some information about attendance, the impact of the exhibitions, and their assessment program and metrics. And then we talked about advertising, and then catalogs and brochures, the physical space, accessibility, funding policies, and the relationship with museums and museum practice, which is how we got to 73 questions. So I tried to address different aspects of exhibition work, and this specific questionnaire is mostly focused about the physical space and exhibitions done within the institutions, but I also had a couple of questions about collaborative exhibitions, so exhibitions outside of their space, and also online exhibitions. But again, it's not the main focus, and again, it's something I hope to get to in the future. So I'm just gonna give you some quick highlights of the findings, and I'll keep it brief so we can continue our session. So I'm gonna just talk about the size of the exhibition team, so how many people work on exhibitions in each institution, how many exhibitions per year they do, their audience, and then just a quick highlight of what are the main stories they try to tell and what are the differences and similarities with museums. So the exhibition team varies, of course, based on the size of the unit and how many people are available. So it's a lot to read, but I try to give some data here. So Georgia State has, depending on the exhibition, 3 to 4 people who are trained on the job. That was one of my questions. Have you been trained on the job, or do you have formal museum and exhibition experience and training from other institutions? So 3 to 4 Georgia State, and the total size of the unit is 12 people plus other ones. UBC has about 3 people working on exhibits, and they do have museum and conservation training. And this full size of the full-time people is 7 people, plus they have other ones from other departments helping. UCLA has 5 to 10 people depending on the exhibition, and the full size is 35 people. Utah has 4 people dedicated to specific floors, and then they all work together, so it's a larger group working on things. HRC, again, has 4 dedicated people, 1 for planning and scheduling, and 3 for preparation and installation, but then, of course, the curators, the conservators, they all work together, so it's a much larger group. And they have training, some have formal training in museums, so they have training from different sources. And the full size of the unit there is 145 people, because it's a very strong place. Santa Clara University has 1 to 3 people working on exhibits, all trained on the job, and they have 6 full-time. Vancouver Public Library has 2 people, and they both have previous museum experience. The Getty Research Institute has 2 full-time, and then a total of 35 people contributing. And of course, since they work for the Getty, they'll add some kind of formal training, and the Getty Museum designers are the ones who design the exhibits for special collections. The Grover Club has 1 person and has a degree in museum studies and information studies, so 2 degrees, and also has had a lot of experience and other training working in exhibition and museum environments. So I'm just gonna give you a quick, I don't know how much, how well you can see images, but I wanted to give you some visuals of the places. So Georgia State, on the first floor, they have a permanent exhibition on Johnny Mercer because they have his collection. And this is supported by the foundation behind it, so it's a permanent exhibition. They also have rotating cases in their special collections area on the second floor. The Getty has different galleries, and this is their current exhibition on the upper level gallery. And you can see how the design is like more of a museum design. This is an older photo of the Grolier Club. They're now revamping all their exhibition spaces, so it's going to look quite different. And this is just an image from the Poe, Edgar Allan Poe exhibit in 2014. This is a current exhibition at the Harry Renzo Center, which is, again, relevant to our theme of the conference. It's called The Stories to Tell. Santa Clara is a beautiful room dedicated to exhibition. It's quite large, has beautiful natural light, which has some preservation concerns, but they are very careful about their materials. So you can get an image here. UBC has cases in the reading room, so it's just embedded in the reading room. UCLA has several spaces in different spots, so I'm giving you just a couple of examples. Vancouver Public Library is, the special collections is positioned in the center of one of the floors, so it's really accessible to everybody, and that's a very busy library, so they get a lot of traffic. So again, they have cases in their reading room, but it's very visible. Utah has spaces on five different floors, so this is just one example. So I also ask people how many exhibition periods they do. Georgia State doesn't have a regular schedule, but they do change a specific collection. The women's collections, they change it once a year because that's part of the donor agreement. UBC does between 4 and 8, and they also work with students, so some exhibitions are actually put together by students, and that's one of the things I did when I was there. We had a really great one about comics. UCLA does 6 to 12. University of Utah does 7 in the Special Collections Gallery and 6 in the Reading Room Gallery and 3 elsewhere, so they're really busy. The Harry Renzo Center just has 2 major exhibits, 1 per semester, which is the model we also moved to at A&M. Santa Clara has 2, they used to have 3, but they're trying to get more structured. The Vancouver Public Library changes every 2 months. And the Getty Research Institute does 3 in the space and 2 off-site. The Grolier Club does 9 in 2 different galleries. Again, they may change after they revamp the space, but this is what they do now. One of the questions I asked what their goals were with the exhibition program. So Georgia State said something that may resonate with some of you. They said initially they were just doing something nice to look at, which does happen a lot. But they're now trying, as I said, they're reinventing their program and they want to be more purposeful and more intentional in what they do. UBC, the main goal is to highlight their collections, materials, engage with the community, and also they have the high school, so they want to engage the students and provide a learning opportunity. UCLA, again, wants to promote materials and providing strong context for interpretation and also reaching different communities. Utah, quite similar, highlighting the materials, expanding their user, their patron and user base, attract new donors, which again may resonate with many of you, and also further the library's mission. UT Austin, the Harry Renzo Center, they have more of a museum mandate, so their answer was quite articulate, and they said, we want to make an intellectual contribution, we want to be innovative, we want to have a broad appeal to diverse communities, we want to bring in audiences of different ages, including school groups and families, build community interest, and also showcase the collection. So they had more of like the mandate that you see in major museums. Santa Clara University, again, their main goal is to support student success and also their marketing and donor development strategy. And again, attracting new donors is something that resonates with many of us. Vancouver Public Library, they want to promote the discovery of special collections, and also they are very, very much complementing the city's cultural calendar, so depending on what's going on in the city at the time, they do have exhibitions that reflect that. At the Getty, they want to promote the collections and also promote research on art history. And the Grolier Club, of course, wants to foster appreciation for books and prints, so anything they do has a link to the history of the book and then bibliography and so on. So just a quick summary. So one of the main goals, of course, is to promote collections. The universities want to support the students and attract donors. Everybody wants to engage the communities and promote interest and research in specific topics. And in general, people want to be innovative and
promote cultural discourse, and this is especially true for the Harriet Ransom Center. So the audience, all these institutions are open to the public and the exhibitions are free of charge. Georgia State targets mostly students, and the audience seems to be pretty much the same, even if the topic changes. UBC is for the UBC community, the researchers, and the general public, similar at UCLA, similar at Utah, but they're also targeting more of the, they have an international community of researchers and supporters, so they also target them. The Ransom Center, again, is targeted at UT and also Austin and Texas in general. Santa Clara is mostly focused on the campus community, and the Vancouver Public Library, as I said, is open really to the city, so their audience changes depending on the topic and depending on what's going on at the time. The Getty is open to the general public, and same with the Grolier Club. So there was, again, I said very rich data, so I can't go in a lot of detail today, but there were some very interesting questions about the topics of the exhibitions, how they chose them, the kind of research that goes into it. And the themes that came out when I asked about narrative, pretty much everybody said we either look at a specific event or a specific individual or an idea or a concept or a trend. Some people look at activism. So this seems to be like pretty much everybody said this in one way or another. Most people, everybody of course wants to showcase their collections, that's one of their narrative. And the University of Utah pointed out that they also want to promote institutional landmarks, so what specifically happened at the university. So some exhibitions are triggered by specific events there. The Vancouver Public Library really emphasized promoting the culture of the city, and the Grolier Club emphasized connecting the patrons to the world of books and print. And again, especially the Harriet Ransom Center, but everybody else also wants to intellectually engage the patrons. And of course, everybody has a strong educational content, one way or another. So differences and similarities with museums, again, just some general reflections. So we're very similar in a lot of ways. I mean, we all want to promote our collections. It doesn't matter if you're a special collections or a museum. We all want to engage with the community. We all try to be visually appealing, and some people are more successful than others, depending, again, on training, on resources, on people available. So I think we're similar in a lot of ways. One of the main differences is that in special collections, rare books and archives, exhibitions are a very important aspect of our everyday work, but they're not the main focus. So usually you have people splitting their time between regular curatorial duties and teaching and a lot of other things, and also doing exhibitions. So in some cases there are dedicated people, like we see at the Harriet Ransom Center and some other places I looked at, but in a lot of places we're all doing a bit of everything. So the exhibition programs in some institutions are very structured, like they have a calendar, they have everything planned out. They design their exhibition with an itinerary and focus and everything else. Other places are a little more free-flowing. They don't have a structured calendar, and they're a little more open. And also, in some cases, you are restrained by the physical space. So in museums, depends on the kind of museum, but in general, you can change the space according to the exhibit you're working on. A lot of times, in special collections and archives, you have the space you have, so you have to work with that. And so these are differences, but if you look at small museums, so they also operate the same, so it's a fine line. So in general, I asked about being trained in museum studies and having experience in museums, I wanted to see if people are interested in bringing museum practice into special collections and archives. And some people already do that very well. Other people don't do it yet, but they want to get there. So overall, everybody seemed to either be applying museum practice or being interested in evolving and getting to a more structured approach. So this is just, again, a very, very quick overview, and I don't want to go over time because we are already delayed by the technical problems, but I'll be happy to answer questions at the end of the session. Thank you so much.
Is this good? I don't know. This is a little closer. A little closer? Better? Okay. Is that fine? Everybody wave at me. Wow, this is really echoey. Okay. So I have a disclaimer, which is that up until about 6 o'clock this morning, I was still working on this presentation because I came in with a very how we've done it good. I've got a number of my colleagues in the audience. How we've done it good approach to designing a permanent exhibit based and grounded in our collections, and with a little bit of big picture thinking about what it means to tell our stories. And as this conference has proceeded, I've had a lot of really great conversations with people at receptions and in the hallway, and I've started to sprinkle things in here that I think apply that I hadn't really thought about until I got here. So it's the best possible scenario where we have the conference theme, which is actually like helping, hopefully, improve what I was going to say. So let's get started. So I work, my office is at the Spencer Research Library at the University of Kansas. And the story about the Spencer Library goes that in the 1960s, KU alumna and philanthropist Helen Forsman Spencer wanted to honor her late husband and asked the university chancellor what she should do, what the university needed. And again, this is a story. The answer was, we need a standalone, purpose-built, rare book manuscript and archive library. So we got one. It would be really fantastic if we had that kind of visibility with very large donors and university administrators today. It's hard to imagine that, it's just hard to imagine that this happened. Ms. Spencer not only paid for the building and ongoing endowments for building equipment and collections. So it's just kind of shocking in 2017 that this kind of thing happens. What you can't see in this picture is that Mrs. Spencer was intimately involved. Oh, I said that. Okay. Generous endowments. See, this is why I have to stay on script. All right. Recent estimates are that we have about 230,000 volumes, including over 3,000 collections of manuscripts and archives. This is all very rough. We have about 25 people who work in the building. Most of the time, some staff are shared across the library system. And we have 4 floors of collection storage plus material in our off-site depository. And that will come in to the talk later. So what you can't see in this now out-of-date photo is that the lovely balcony there was actually a disaster because it caused water intrusion in stacks below. Condensation was a constant problem, and we had significant challenges with UV and visible light on the spectrum in the space that we're going to be talking about today. So here's another shot of the other facade, which is actually the entrance, even though the other one looked like it. So really, our collections, I think probably like a lot of collections where institutions where you work, are our blessing and our curse because they are so varied. We have all formats, legacies of descriptive practices that are challenging to integrate. And also, I think it was really interesting to hear Francesca talk about kind of the mission, because our mission is very much grounded in the university, but we do serve everyone, and we're state assisted. So just a little highlights. We have regional history, photographs, documents, diaries in the Kansas collection, university archives, whiskey bottle, Becky. I think it's a whiskey bottle, Jayhawk whiskey bottle.
What?
Never mind. From Thurgood Marshall to Charles Scott on versus Board of Education, yeah. And the Wilcox collection of contemporary American political movements, and then our special collections, which is just going to be quick highlights. One of the largest collections of 18th century material in North America, history of science, 19th and 20th century literature, especially with emphasis on New American poetry and the Beats, and science fiction, Renaissance and early modern imprints, arguably the largest collection of Irish material outside of Dublin. We rank 15th among the top 15 institutions, I don't actually know what the rank is, for holdings in pre-1600 manuscript codices in the United States and Canada. We have approximately 220 pre-1600 manuscript books, and this is our Vosper Hours, 15th century French Hours of the Virgin. So we have a lot of different kinds of things. We do a very brisk business in our Stockstead reading room, including roughly 2,000 visits per year. That includes roughly 600 undergraduate visits, 300 graduate student visits, and close to 400 independent researchers. Considering there's no parking anywhere near, it's actually kind of impressive. So one of the first, there's a classroom, we have classes, you get the idea. One of the first things that I did when I came back to Kansas was to find a way to reinstitute an exhibit program. It had been discontinued under my predecessor for a lot of perfectly understandable reasons, but like our moderator, I felt that it was very important to have exhibits as in some kind of sustainable way. So we have an exhibit space with a rather traditional library schedule, and I was encouraged that we're not that far out of the norm, I think. We rotate three shows a year, focused very strongly in our collections. And we've done a few different things, like involving museum studies, students who can work in this space as a laboratory. I constantly remind my colleagues that less is more, but we still tend to be very text and label driven. We are telling a lot of stories already. Outside of our researchers on site, in 2016, we had roughly 4,000 non-researcher participants who came in the building. We use Aon, so I can tell you these things. Those were about 4,000 people in classes, tours, events, receptions, etc. So one space in particular has been key to telling our story since the building opened in 1968. Nearly every tour or casual visitor comes through this space, which was known as the ambulatory and is often known as either the Red Room or the Room with the Books. And it's become a key component to our identity. This is several years ago, a shot of the North Gallery with no event going on. And the story goes that Mrs. Spencer was inspired by the Stack Tower at the Beinecke Library at Yale. And this is how it turned out in a much more modest Midwestern scale. Again, we like to tell stories about Mrs. Spencer. So just a couple of things I want to point out. You see the metal frame structure that kind of surrounds the glass. You can't see them in this picture, but there were several niches within there were several empty shelves, essentially, within the shelving. And there were a number of things that had been on display. There were horn books and a Roman memorial stone and some other things. That vision kind of shaped our approach. And we had a legacy of unintentional permanent exhibit of objects, which it upsets our conservator quite a bit. So you see the red room there, the red carpet. Oh, there's the Beinecke. Yeah, there you go. So this is the other side. In the left, on the left shot, you see the structure there. The space has housed everything ranging from academic speakers and receptions to a vocal performance off that water permeable balcony and a successful marriage proposal. And there's the happy couple. So the opportunities you see are that a lot of people would set foot in the Spencer Research Library for the first or perhaps only time to attend an event in the North Gallery. And the open book stacks are compelling evidence of the primacy of our physical collections. Nowhere else on campus are paper-based collections available to be viewed even in a very cursory way in this kind of space. We've done a significant amount of renovation in other spaces to work on telling our stories and providing our services. So, you know, for example, with the Open Bookstax, one of the things I always did when I gave a tour was that you could see in our pre-1700 Summerfield collection, you could see manuscript waste for music manuscripts that was used in bindings. And just walking by, even with no interpretive element, that was an opportunity to tell something about the history of the book. What didn't work was that everything that was on display had been there since 1968, and it represented only a part of our collections, and in my mind wasn't even the most important or compelling part of our collection. We kept hitting our head against the wall trying to figure out how to refresh the space, how to bring in more diversity in the collections, and we realized that we needed help. So we started working with exhibit design group Interactive, who had worked on a similar scale project in a museum in town. And the first question that they had us ask was, who are our audiences? And again, I'm hearkening back to what Francesca has found, many, many audiences. And again, I think you probably have this kind of problem in your institutions. We serve many masters, and we actively collect the regional, the personal, and the marginalized. So we take very seriously our commitment to be open to everyone. And scholars. So what did we want to tell? We kept asking ourselves this, and we started out with some pressure from our consultant, who was taking a very museum-based approach and wanted us to tell the story of some of our significant donors, or Mrs. Spencer herself, about whom there are many entertaining stories. But we figured that it really all came down to the collections, or so we thought. We only had so much space, and we really wanted to honor the aesthetic and the history of the space without doing violence to it in a, you know, a real rough way. So work on planning began in earnest in 2012, although things had been percolating quite a bit before that. And we had lots of meetings, lots and lots of meetings, lots of drafts, edits, so many edits. And the team was two curators, one of whom, Elspeth Healy, is in the room, and our archivist, Becky Schulte, our head of public services, Interactive Group, and the contribution of so many people in stacks and facility support, digitization, conservation, all of those things. So eventually, we realized that we needed to bring out examples of all collections, not just focus on books, which had been the focus in the previous space. We wanted to educate while giving a sense of our mission and purpose, but we also realized it was a fine line between educating and boring people. And we wanted to help build advocacy on and off campus. So this is really where the tensions were, and I think it's pretty clear that these are things that we struggle with all the time in our exhibits, but the stakes seemed so much higher this time because this exhibit was going to be installed probably for another 50 years. Nobody wants to go through it again. So how do we balance experts who would be in our spaces and who would know more about these things than we do, for example, versus casual visitors who have no idea what early printing is about? The selectiveness versus comprehensiveness was a huge challenge. Honoring the space, honoring the past of our institution while looking to the future, and the money issue, the donation from Mrs. Spencer, honoring that while also understanding that we needed to receive more funds, and we did receive more funds, and of course the library way versus the museum way, and there were a couple of examples, you know, whether or not we would include call numbers when we refer to a piece of from our collection. How interactive were the interactives? And I'm not sure that we really all feel really good about that. But they're pretty interactive. And in fact, I had to keep reminding myself that, you know, this is not a children's museum, but it's going to be okay. So these were the renderings, and you'll see that the those niches that I alluded to are kind of incorporated into the design, and there was stuff on the walls. Originally, we only had Originally, we only had funding to do the exhibit within and on the outside of the stack core, but our consultant said, well, this is what you could do if you had new lighting and replace these horrible 1968 fluorescents. And, you know, so in the meantime, we actually received a very generous estate gift, and we were able to expand the scope of the project to do a physical renovation as well. And so we bumped out the balcony, and it became a faux balcony. And we were able to replace lighting fixtures and a carpet and a lot of other things. So it serves a preservation purpose, but it's also aesthetically very, very pleasing. So the changes and the delays of the delays were actually a good thing from our perspective. So I'm going to walk you really quickly through a couple of slides which I got yesterday from our communications team. We don't have everything in yet, but this is a sneak peek. You saw it here first. So we have some welcome information, and then those rails that we are here, that I was telling you about. What I don't show is that we've installed some temporary cases that, with the idea that we would have a very organic and quick way to put a few things in a case with very minimal signage that would allow us to respond to events on campus or visiting conferences or something without doing a full-scale exhibit and without tying up our staff who would otherwise have to be in a classroom with materials. So we'll see how that goes. Here's another shot. This is that North Gallery space. This is the that iconic shot there. Looks a little bit different. So here's the bump out. We've got electric shades, which makes our conservator happy, and quite a bit more space for events. And you know, this is a multi-purpose space, so it's really it was a real challenge to say it is an exhibit space, but it's also where the chancellor brings the chancellor's club for lunch. So how do we balance those? And I think we've done a pretty good job. This is a close-up on one of those multimedias, which, you know, to my mind looks an awful lot like a museum. So this is just the beginning. We're just kicking off our publicity, which will also be aimed at multiple audiences. Public Service is developing a self-guided tour. We're also going to incorporate a large print format, and we're going to have some transcriptions for English language learners and the hearing impaired. Theoretically, everything is modular and updatable. We're going to be introducing audio and projection capabilities for events because we all know how important those are. We are not going to have the projector drop down from the ceiling. I just decided that this morning. We're scheduling regular drop-in tours, so it's our hope that, again, despite the fact that we're on top of a hill and that we have no parking, if we get on a calendar and get the word out that people can say at a certain time every week, come by and get a tour, not just of this space, but of our entire building. The education piece is that we're all, the team learned as we went that we learned about the collections and we learned about our own priorities, and now we have to accept what we've got. And there's ongoing fundraising and outreach. So now the stories that we tell, I think, are richer. I had an anecdote from Elspeth that the Campbell Science Fiction Conference was on campus, and she took attendees through the space, not open yet. The multimedia included clips of interviews that tied into the conference theme. And we also had alumni from Sumner High School, which was a historic African-American high school in Kansas City, Kansas. And they were able to use the clips from sort of promotional videos from the school as they went, again, without having to, people can delve deeper into some of our collections without additional staff time or conservation work. So our permanent exhibit space now tells many stories. It tells the history of the Jayhawk mascot, Langston Hughes' time in Lawrence, how early books were printed, Sanborn fire insurance maps, etc. But I think, more importantly, it tells stories about our primary sources, our role as a campus partner, and the fact that you, whoever you are welcome here, which is a slogan for our KU libraries. In my mind, it really tells the story of the institution itself. And as Spencer Research Library approaches the year to celebrate our 50th anniversary, I cannot think of a better way to tell that story. Thank you. so let's see. Is this echoey, good, bad? Okay, so I just don't move ever. All right, we'll see how that works. So good morning, and thank you all for persevering through our technical challenges. My presentation this morning would have been a lot less interesting without the visuals. So, as you might guess from the title. So, I am the Director of Digital Learning and User Experience for the Harvard Library Central Organization. So, I'm not actually a special collections librarian. I don't even play one on TV. I run, as part of our department, we run a lab called the User Research Center, which is a usability and user experience lab for the Harvard Library, and we also serve other parts of the Harvard community. Shameless self-promotion, I have some cards if anybody's interested. But one of the things that we were able to do, because we had some grant funding for starting up the lab, was to invest in some technology that allows us to do some really interesting research. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, is an exploratory study to try to understand how visitors engage in a more micro level with special collections exhibitions. So the study is very much exploratory. There isn't actually that much research that uses this technology. And the original idea, what we did was to compare two different exhibitions that were in two different Harvard libraries, Houghton Library, Shakespeare, His Collected Works, and Opening New Worlds, the Colonial North American Project, which was on exhibition in the Pusey Gallery put on by the Harvard University Archives. And I picked these two because, for one reason, is that they had very different physical layouts. So one of the interesting things was to see how that might affect how people view exhibitions, but because of the time constraints for this particular presentation, I'm actually focusing on questions 2 and 3 from this study. So for today, I'm going to focus mostly on the Shakespeare exhibition and looking at how users explore items in individual cases and how they actually read labels. And these questions were really generated by conversations with curators and other library staff who spend so much time and effort putting together all of these wonderful exhibitions, but then not really knowing actually what anybody does once you put everything in the case. So because we have this fun little lab, we have technology called wearable eye tracking. And this is cool. Some people have also described it as creepy, but I choose to go with cool. This actually allows us to see, literally see, what the visitor is experiencing as they walk through the space. So for practical purposes, in order to do this research with the technology, we had participants spend about 6 minutes viewing one of the two exhibitions while wearing the glasses. So it's not like a comprehensive study of their whole visit. We did make sure to tell people, you know, that they could look at anything they wanted. We didn't mention anything about labels, so we weren't trying to, you know, prejudge them. And we also told them that they could continue to browse the exhibition after they were done. But just so that we could schedule participants and make sure people could, you know, show up and get in and out. And 6 minutes is actually a lot of data for this kind of stuff. So that's just sort of some of the trade-offs in terms of being able to do the study. We also had a short post-visit questionnaire where we asked them, you know, how much they enjoyed the exhibition, and they loved them, so that was good. Their interest level, their knowledge, their familiarity with the subject matter. So that's what we did. So in the actual study, we had 34 participants total. But one of the things with doing eye tracking is that you have to calibrate each person who puts the glasses on, and occasionally that calibration doesn't work. But we don't tell people that because then they feel like, what's wrong with me? Why did I fail? Especially at Harvard, you don't want to tell anybody that, like, they failed. That's bad. So we just let people, you know, kind of continue on, but we don't use that data. So we had 23 participants that had valid eye tracking data that we could then perform additional analysis on. And so most of the participants were either undergraduates or graduate students at Harvard, although we did have 3, I think, just visitors who signed up to participate in the study, so that was kind of cool.
One of the interesting things, you know, we were originally hoping to see, like, how did knowledge of the subject matter affect people's interaction patterns, but from the survey, from the questionnaire data, there really wasn't that much variation in participants' either familiarity, knowledge, or interest levels, so they were all kind of moderately interested. So, for example, we didn't get any, like, super-duper Shakespeare scholars where we could see that somebody had in-depth experience. So, I mean, this is basically sort of your typical visitor, not somebody who's really a subject matter expert looking at these exhibitions. And they were slightly higher, the scores were slightly higher for Shakespeare versus Colonial North America. I think that's because everybody knows who Shakespeare is, and the Colonial North American Project, while it was really big, visible at Harvard, I think if you're not a historian, you might not quite know what that was. So this is wearable eye tracking. This is Maura, who's one of our staff members at Harvard Library. So basically, you get, hopefully this picture looks okay on the screen. These are these glasses. So this is, the manufacturer's called Toby. And this is, so this is her looking at us in the space, looking back at her. It's a little inception there. And how these work, so you can see a different view, is that basically there's an HD camera that's in the center of the lens. They have these removable lenses. We actually take the lenses off because they don't do anything. So I was like, well, then why have them? So then inside these rims here, so this is where the magic happens, the glasses have infrared sensors and little micro cameras, and that's what it uses to actually detect where the participant is actually looking within that field of vision. Sorry, excuse me. Okay, so this is the glasses, and then they just have like a little kind of battery pack thing that the participant carries around. So what you get then is the eye tracking takes that data and gives us a video, and it overlays this little circle, which, yeah, that's the arrows pointing to the circle. There's a circle there. And this gives you, so this is the whole field of vision. So this is everything that's in the camera's view. But then the circle tells you the specific point within that field of vision that that participant is focusing on. And so I have, hopefully, yes, a little video to show you to give you a better sense of what this looks like. This is what I really wanted, the visuals. So I'm going to play in a second, but if you can see the circle here, so this is the participant's gaze. So this is going to start tracking across the screen, and this is at Houghton with the Shakespeare exhibition. So what you can see then is this gives us the literally telling us within this case where the person is. So not really a lot of sustained, careful attention. Oh, and there's a picture on the wall. To the Edison and Newman Room, but it also houses the library's collection of incunabula. I hope I'm going to look and say, yeah, I got that right. So there's a lot of pretty books that people also like to look at that are just there. And so, yeah, so people, you see that a lot, people just kind of like looking around. But also you can see, you know, so how their attention shifts from different objects. So this poster was part of the exhibition. I don't remember if this is the person who does the bad thing or not.
Oh.
Somebody peeked behind the curtain. You're not supposed to do that. That's why the curtain's there. Okay, so this is not in that. So that just gives you a sense of like this is what wearable eye tracking looks like. So but it tells you information that you would not, it gives you that story that you wouldn't otherwise be able to know. So a lot of museum studies, for example, use observation, so you can kind of sit there, you can see where people go, but you can't, from just natively observing somebody, you can't see what they're actually doing when you're looking at that case, because it's just someone standing there. So this gives you a much different level of understanding their experience. Okay. So
one of the requirements for the analysis that I'm going to present to you today is high-quality still images. So once we do the data collection, we have software that also comes from the vendor that allows us to map that video onto a still image, and then from there, it calculates a whole smorgasbord of metrics. So one of the reasons that I'm also focusing just on the Shakespeare exhibition is because, unfortunately, we weren't able to get the high-quality stills from the Colonial North American exhibition, and the pictures that we did have didn't really align, and the cases weren't weirdly shaped. So I also learned a whole lot about, like, I need a better exhibition space in order to actually do this research, because things have to align in order for the software to match it up. But we did have, thankfully, the curators at Houghton had taken pictures right at the start of the exhibition, standing on a nice little ladder, so we had great images for each of the main eight exhibit cases, and that's what I'm going to be focusing on. A couple of other things, just definitionally, that I'll be talking about as I go through. So in eye tracking, we talk a lot about something called fixations. So a fixation is basically the slow, minute movements of the eyes that are somewhere between like 500 to 600 milliseconds, and that's what in eye tracking research, what we use is the proxy for attention. So it's basically like where the focus is, as opposed to the very rapid scanning movements. And then we use fixations to determine what we call a visit, which in eye tracking is the period of time from when a participant first focuses on a region to when they look away. And then we calculate, so a lot of the things I'm going to be talking about later are total visit duration, which is the combination of all of the visits for each participant, and then we draw in the software an area of interest. So basically I just draw a little box around this label and call that that area of interest, and then it calculates those fixations within that area that I've drawn. Does that make sense? It's a lot of stuff. So, here's the Edison Newman Room. Shakespeare has collected works at Houghton Library. As you saw from the video, and you can see here, we have the cases, and there's also wall hangings. So, these are the eight cases that this analysis focuses on. People did look at the posters and other items in the wall, but this is what we had the images for that we could connect to the eye tracking software. And so then these are, we had 12 of the participants for Shakespeare who had valid eye tracking data. So all of this is going to be based on those 12 participants. So this is still very much an exploratory study. It's not enough people to make firm statistical conclusions, but it does give us a lot of interesting suggestions for future research. So the first thing we do with eye tracking often is to see if there are any overall patterns in how people engaged with the cases. So this is, I picked a sample of four different cases and looked at the heat maps. So the software, once we draw our areas of interest, allows us to generate heat maps that calculate the intensity, or basically the duration of the fixations within that area. Has anybody seen heat maps and other things before? So yeah, so you use heat maps a lot. So the red areas are the areas of the most intense focus. And so one of the things that I noticed as soon as I went through the heat maps, and I was sort of expecting something else, was that there weren't really any clear patterns. So when we look at studies of the web, for example, when we do eye tracking on computer screens, you see over and over and over again very clear patterns where people look down the left side and across the top. And you can see that in like basically any website ever. I did not see any kind of real clear pattern emerge from these 12 participants. So you can see in case one, we have little hotspots down here at the bottom, some hotspots over here. In case three, we've got bottom, we've got left, we've got right. We got a whole bunch of stuff here at the top and a little bit of hotspots here in the middle. So, and this is like this for all of the cases. So this was, again, an interesting finding because we didn't see anything clearly like everybody's going left to right or top to bottom or something like that. To do then a further step of analysis, we use something called a gaze plot. This is probably very hard to see, but each of the circles here represents one fixation, and the colors are different participants. So for all of the participants who looked at case five, they're a different color. And then there are numbers inside that represent the order of the fixation. So this allows you to track each person's actual trajectory through that case. So what I did here is, for the ones that I could find, is highlighted their first fixation. So each arrow is pointing to where one participant started in that case. And there's no pattern. So again, this is still exploratory, but it's very interesting to see that, like, oh, somebody looked at top, we've got left, right, top, bottom, right? Like, basically everywhere. And so that, again, suggests that there's not necessarily one way that people approach at least this particular type of exhibition case. And the only thing that I did see when I was looking at the actual videos, so the cases at Houghton are numbered. In this particular exhibition, the content was arranged thematically and not chronologically, but there have been kind of chronological exhibitions in that space. But about half of the students actually started, or the participants started with case 8, which is theoretically the end, rather than the first one, which is the beginning. So basically, some people went counterclockwise and other people went clockwise throughout the room. So you can see a little bit of difference in how they approach the cases, because the counterclockwise people, you know, kind of went from right to left. But even still, when they look within a case, it's not always a clear pattern. So to give you a sense of how much time participants spent with each case, this chart is the average and the median of the total visit lengths, the visit duration across all of the participants by case. So each case is a different color, and this is in seconds. Sorry. Now then, remember that this was 6 minutes. We could do a different experiment to see if we told people 10 minutes or 20 minutes, if they did longer, I don't know, but and people were also looking at other things in the room besides these cases, so it's not the sum total of their entire exhibit visit, but we have 3 cases that have kind of the longest visit durations, cases 8, 3, and 1, but also see that in some cases we have pretty big differences between the median and the average. And looking at the data, we can see that there's a few participants who spent a lot longer in those cases, and so they're sort of throwing those averages off. So we have some super interested folks. Again, not every participant went to every case in their 6 minutes. So some people just looked at like 3 or 4 cases and spent longer, and some people just went doop-de-doop-de-doop-de-doop around the room. So again, one of the big trends is there's a lot of individual variation in participant behavior. So I did a little bit of a deeper dive into case 4, because that was the only case that all 12 of the participants stopped at. So this is case 4. I cannot remember the theme. Actors? No, something else. Anyway, Peter Ricardo's not here, so I'm just going to make it up. He's got some cool stuff in there. I've been looking at this stuff for so long, I should actually have memorized this, but I forgot what the theme was. So this is the heat map for case 4. So you can see there's really only one hot spot, which is this label. This is a photo of John Barrymore as Hamlet. And so people did look at the photo, and that's something that you can see here. So this is true from other research on eye tracking. People look at faces. We're social creatures. That's what we do. They tend to look at photographs and paintings and specifically, like, look at the faces. But it's interesting that actually the label got the most focused attention in this case. And so I was able to look at the percentage of participants who fixated on each one of these areas of interest. And so these objects here, this is a painting, and I think this is an engraving, had 100% of the participants who fixated on it, but it's a very light green because they were very, very short fixations. So there's that difference between how many people glanced at something versus how many really looked at it carefully. So this gives you, this is our gaze plot for case 4. A little bit of a better sense. So again, we have these items that had kind of 100% fixations. The other thing that was really popular was this letter down here. It had 91% of the participants fixated on that. And this is a photo of the Booth brothers, of the James Wilk Booth fame and a playbill from a performance of theirs. So this got 83% of participants fixated. And the rapier here, which belonged to one of the Booth brothers, is had about 67%. And in all of these cases, the items themselves had more fixations than the labels, but again, that varied. So 58% of the participants fixated on this label, but 75% fixated on this label. So, and then as I did earlier, I've just highlighted some of the first fixations for these participants. So again, you can see some folks started down here. There's a few people starting in the top left, and somebody started here on the playbill. From the videos, I'm pretty sure a few people started on the rapier, but I couldn't find the actual circles in this diagram. So I also did some more charts. To get a better sense of how folks engaged with case four specifically, I grouped all of the labels together and then all of the sort of objects, letters, books, etc. together, and then split those up. So here, each color is a participant. So these are the sort of, go back. These are the just code names for the participants. And so one of the other interesting findings then is really reinforcing this pattern where on average, participants are actually spending more time with the labels than the objects themselves, but there's a lot of individual variation across the participants. So you have to look at both things because the averages don't always tell you everything. You can see that, so some people tend to be very internally consistent, right? So they're like, always look at the labels, or this person never looks at, like, anything. And so that's what's interesting. You see these things, like, some people just are like, I'm here to get my free water bottle or something. That's about participating. But it's still interesting because so you see, like, some of these folks who pay pretty much decent amount of attention. And then to follow up, because this was a question that had come up for conversations with some of the curators and some folks, and some of the literature had this magical, like, phrase of 55 words, but I've not been able to track, the one source I tracked down didn't seem to have any sort of data to back that up. So I'm a social scientist, and I'm like, where's your data? So I was interested, does word count make a difference? And I kind of think the answer is no, at least not for these 12 participants in this study. So I looked at the word counts for the labels. This is just in cases 1 through 4, so the first half of the exhibition, and grouped them by either under 75 words, 75 to 99, or 100 or more words, which was about 3 equal categories. So that, I guess, Houghton writes lengthier labels. I'm just looking at John, because it's not like you are the curator of this exhibition. But so interestingly, the averages for each 3 categories are about the same. So whether it was a shorter label, a mid-sized label, or a longer label, people spent between 20 and 30 seconds basically on those labels. Again, you can see the medians are a little bit different right here in the 75 to 99 because, again, of some outliers. And so that's why in the top here, I know it's probably hard to see, there's a group by participants. So we see, again, this person spent a lot more time with the labels that were shorter, but this person spent roughly an equal amount of time with all of the labels, regardless of how long they were. And then, again, here's a person who doesn't read anything. So really, there's what I was taking away from this is that we're looking at maybe patterns where maybe people have sort of visit, I don't know, orientations. Like some people just go through an exhibition a certain way based on, you know, their own orientation. So this is the last chart, I promise. I'm coming up with 3 categories. This is still very much a hypothesis rather than a firm conclusion. So, you know, as a good social scientist, more research is always necessary. But I'm hypothesizing that we can group people into 3 very broad categories as sort of readers, skimmers, or scanners. So the readers, and you can see this even better with the chart with like a million numbers, but I didn't want to sort of show that to you today because it's really ugly. Readers tend to look at a at least most things in the case. So they at least glance at everything. They will often single out a number of things to look at carefully, and they tend to spend roughly equal amounts of time per item and per case. So they're a bit more methodical in their approach to the exhibitions. We have two folks here that kind of represent readers. The scanners will tend to pick out like one or two things and look at those for a comparatively longer period of time, and then maybe just skip or briefly notice the rest of the stuff. So somehow they're like finding the one thing that catches their attention, they really pay attention to that, and then maybe they move on. And then we have the scanners, like our friend E21, who barely look at anything, really. They might, in one case or two cases, look at something for a long period of time, but when you look at their behavior across all of the cases, it's very much like flip from thing to thing to thing. One of these folks was also one of the persons who just did a lot of scanning just around the room, kind of trying to find something to look at. So that's leads me to, again, some more conclusions, but really suggestions for things to look at in the future. So participants do read the labels. So that was, I think, you know, a lot of questions, right? Is anybody reading all of these things? Now, again, these were comparatively longer labels. I mean, even the shortest label was still over, I think, 50 words. At least in this particular exhibit at Houghton, we didn't have anything that was really short. So another, you know, more research that looked at like really, really short labels, like 15, 20 words, versus the expositions that we have in these labels might show maybe different patterns, I don't know. But at least some folks are not deterred by even, you know, labels that are over 100 words, which is a nice paragraph of text. The other thing is that rather than seeing consistent patterns across the exhibition, what I've seen here is participant behavior that's internally consistent and that can be then potentially grouped, but rather than there's not one way that people are like always looking at the left or always looking at the right. And then obviously more research is needed in order to, and looking at different kinds of exhibition spaces, so I'm really interested in all the pictures that Francesca had because, you know, triangles or squares, all these kinds of things, I still think that there is the potential that the space itself, and you know, that is going to affect how people interact with these items. So there's lots and lots of potential research that we can do to flesh this out more. So thank you very much.
All right, so we should have at least 10 minutes for questions, and we can go over if we need to. I will bring this microphone around so that everyone can hear your question. If that's, I think that'll work. Yeah.
Hi, Molly.
First observation, I'd like you to suppress all information about length of label because I want to convince my people to write short labels.
Okay.
totally
I'm sorry.
Anyway, I just have to say that. I had a couple observations about the scanners.
Mm-hmm.
Necessarily because I always have, you know, young curators who always say to me, like, well, let's put an arrow on the floor, which I did the first exhibition. I asked if I could put an arrow on the floor, and my boss was like, no, you can't put an arrow on the floor. And I was like, but people need to go the right way. And, you know, and no. So first of all, there's that. The second thing is, it looks to me like there's no indication in that exhibition to what each case is about and a narrative to the case. It makes sense to me that people were kind of scanning over the whole case and then picking out totally different things based on their own personal interests. But, like, if you don't know what the case is about or what the narrative of the exhibition is about, I've learned that signage is hugely important. And I recently did an exhibition where, you know, usually they have a nice big label at the beginning of the case that says this is what this case is about. And for my latest exhibition, massive sign, like this big, with the letters this huge at the top of each case, and visitors, it just says, this is, it's on Faulkner, so it's like, schoolboy, screenwriter, people have actually come and said, I love that you put these big signs up, and they actually come on actively, so I think that there's a traditional exhibition format that's very, like, immerse yourself in a specific book, you know, you must rigorous and find the narrative yourself, and I think it's really good to do a lot of the wayfinding for your visitor. And so that's not the exhibition, really.
Well, I have data, actually. So because we didn't have the photos, I couldn't do the eye-tracking analysis on colonial North America, but we did a qualitative analysis of just looking at the videos. So I don't know if any of you have ever sort of been to the Harvard University archives. That space is a long hallway that's angled, and it's a weird building. And then there's sort of another area at the end that also connects to another library that has another exhibition gallery from the MAPS collection. And also there's these giant poles that hold the building up. So it's very different from the nice rectangular room that Houghton has. And so a couple things to that point. And they also have their cases, they have vertical cases as well as one really, really long horizontal case. So they, in the Colonial North American case, they had very large sides at the back of each case that had that narrative, and we definitely saw people looking at those. Houghton did not have any narrative. There was a teeny tiny little label in each case that said the themes was like actors, actresses, Shakespeare at Harvard. I can't even remember what the other ones were, but that was it for that exhibition. And there was one kind of placard. So there was the first photo that was in its own case, and then there was a placard there. Not everybody looked at that. And it, from to cross the room from when you walk in, they have made bigger ones more recently, so I don't know if the bigger size has helped. But also in Colonial North America, so we started people at different ends to see how that weird configuration, and it definitely affects people, because if you start at the sort of wrong end from the MAPS collection, which lots of people are going to do because you can come in from that other library, you can't even see the other cases. Like, they're literally invisible because of the way the wall goes. So, and then people who started that exhibition didn't often make it to the rest of that because they just didn't know there was anything there. So the archives have now started putting giant signs on the big poles saying, exhibition continues this way, as a direct result of this research. And I think it's probably, if we were to go back, I think it's probably made a difference because you have to tell people because you can't see them. Whereas the people who started at the sort of right end did manage to kind of follow the exhibition. And they had a lot more kind of wall panels and wall signs, and those did seem to capture people's attention. The things that were hanging on the wall in Houghton were actually part of the exhibition rather than kind of narrative text. So people did look at them, but they were just more posters and things like that rather than like signage.
Can I ask you about the label thing though? I think if I'm understanding your data, if the amount of time spent on a given participant for labels is the same regardless of the length of the label, that means they're actually reading more of a shorter label and less of a longer label because you can only read so fast and so many words. Is that correct? So I think for me that's the takeaway. You know, even if you have long labels, sure, people might read them. Some people might skim them, but they're not going to get as much
And that's why it's important to look at also the medians, because in some cases there are some like longer times that are throwing off the averages, and then that's, but yeah, so people are at least looking at them I was trying to find the research on, like, how long does it take people to read stuff? And that's actually an interesting question, that as a lot of stuff is done by reading out loud, which I think is a different time speed than reading to yourself. I mean, I just time myself, and I could get through a 100-word label in, like, 25 seconds. But not, like, reading closely for, you know, like, this is going to be on a quiz, right? But just, so I think, again, it's, like, how much depth, and what you do see with some people, and that's, I didn't present this information, which is the visit count, so some people do return back to the same item multiple times. Most people didn't do that, but there are, again, those folks who are like, looked at it, looked away, came back, and so that's giving you kind of, that they're engaging more with particular pieces of the exhibition. It just was where everybody stopped. That exhibition at Houghton had a lot of stuff in each case. So was it right after it was Beyond Words? I forget when Beyond Words came in the order, but there was a big medieval manuscript exhibition that had much, like, fewer, sometimes only three or four, but very large manuscripts per case. We didn't have a chance to time to do another study on that, but I think definitely looking at different kinds of case arrangements would be interesting. I mean, and the archives was also interested in that, just because for colonial North America, everything is an 18th century manuscript. Like, that's just what the stuff is. And so it's hard to put any kind of visual variety, because that was the theme and the point, and all of the materials are basically like brown pieces of paper. From a visual, like, that sounds so like snarky, don't tell anybody at the archives I said that, but really interesting, but just in terms of that visual, like, where you, and that's why I think we really saw people look at the big signs that they had, because they had a colored banner, and they were in large font. The fonts in the archives were bigger than the fonts at Houghton. And I do think that, you know, having a larger font, just again, like, to call people, makes a difference. So I sound like I'm really being mean to Houghton, and poor Tom is standing there in the back, just like.
Yes. I sort of read that as, if I remember correctly, it was case one, case four, and case eight, that had the biggest kind of interest levels. And it could be as simple as the setup of the cases, as you say. So there are people who start with case one, that's where they spent the most amount of time. There are people who started or entered at case eight. At the end, they spend a lot of time on that case. Case four is at the end of the run. So people kind of have this feeling that there's nothing next to it. And so you just kind of naturally stop and you spend a little bit more time kind of trying to orient yourself within the exhibit itself. I'm at DePaul University. We have on our first floor two kind of large vertical cases separated by our entrance. Mm-hmm. And a stairwell on each side. So it's a really big kind of space to walk across and expect viewers to make like a cogent narrative jump literally between these two cases. And so we kind of abandoned the idea of trying to continue a narrative across, because people will either just stop and they don't know there's another case over there, or by the time they make it over there, their focus has changed such that it doesn't really matter what was in case one. Mm-hmm. They're ready to start anew.
Yeah, so we have, so case one is the beginning, case eight is actually also, and that's the end, but when you walk in the door, that's the one that's right on your right-hand side, so I mean, that's where you kind of see like about half of the people sort of went doop and just looked right there because it was right next to them, and then the other one was case three actually, which is in the, you know, middle of the rung, but what we see a lot, again, at Houghton, but also saw this to a certain extent at the archives, is people also looking at the other things, and the two posters at the end, which we couldn't do the analysis on because we didn't have still photos of them, but they did, just from looking at the videos, get a fair amount of attention. So there was a Caliban poster on one end of the room, and they were very colorful, so people looked at those a lot, especially right as they entered the room, and then went back to those, and then a number of people like walk behind the cases to look at the books, and so again, all of that other stuff that people are looking at isn't captured in these data because this is just specifically about those cases. But yeah, I mean, people look at a lot of things in that space.
Since we just installed the permanent exhibit, we don't have anything in place yet. In our rotating exhibits, we do have a guest book, and we have a gate count, and that's about it. So I think we probably would be looking at something like focus groups, because, you know, this is a space that you walk past a receptionist, and then you go in, and we have no idea. You know, we don't require our casual visitors to register with AON, which would give us a lot of demographic data but that we have for our researchers. So I think we're definitely hoping to have in the fall sort of reaction sessions, focus groups, whatever, but I don't think we can get any really hardcore quantitative data. But I'd love, I mean, if it's possible, that would be fantastic too.
So right now we're just collecting numbers of the, how many visitors come, and I have the signing book with the comments, so that's very minimal. So we want to build an assessment program, so we're thinking about focus groups also and surveys. I'm going to try this one. And I'm also interested in getting data not just about the exhibit itself, but also accessibility. So we're trying to improve our accessibility. Right now we're offering binders with the captions, the labels in the cases and on the walls, but then we're offering binders with dyslexic font, large font, so we're giving some alternatives. All our videos, of course, are captioned now, so we're slowly getting to be more accessible, but our cases are old, like they were put there when the renovation was done over 20 years ago. So I did a test with a couple of colleagues, and they gave me feedback, like one is in a wheelchair, and she couldn't see inside, so I would like to eventually get funding and get all new cases, but also when I do assessment, I would like to ask not just about the content, but about the experience as a whole, including accessibility.
So, I mean, I don't actually work for any of those libraries. I mean, I think most of our libraries that have exhibition spaces at Harvard try to do at least some kind of gate count. You do door counts at Houghton. I mean, for some of the libraries, it's difficult because they don't necessarily have somebody sitting there in front of the exhibition. You know, we have so many different spaces with weird layouts. I know that they try to get that from for the archives at PUCY, which the only person that can do it is the security guard, so it's a little bit of a, like, organizational kind of make sure that the security guard actually does that. And again, people can walk in from the wrong way, so then it's hard to know, like, because the space is just the way the space is. And so I don't know if anybody else at Harvard in the libraries has done any other kind of real exhibition assessment. I don't know, do you know? Yeah.
Any library who might have a specific training or have a partnership with people with technical skills.
The cost is a lot. Like,
how a lot?
This has been like 2 years ago that we bought this, but I kind of think it was around $17,000 for the whole shebang. Now, there are other eye tracking manufacturers. This is a kind of, because we had a grant, so we just, you know, bought the best. There are other people, so you can probably like comparison shop, but it's not cheap. But so we also have screen-based eye trackers in the lab, which are a lot more fiddly. The glasses are actually pretty simple. So I had a graduate student who did the actual data collection, and I trained her up, and she was able to do that. And then we trained a different graduate student to work on some of the analysis. So I mean, I think it's not that hard to learn. Actually, you just have to kind of do a little bit of training, but you could learn it. Somebody who's reasonably technically savvy and kind of interested in that could learn it, you know, a few hours, and, you know, it just takes time getting used to, like, the terminology and things like that, but I don't think it's, like, super-duper hard to learn. It's mostly the price hurdle is the hard, but, like, if you went in with other libraries or museums, so I've been given a couple presentations to the museums at Harvard, and I'm hoping that someday we can do a partnership with some of them, because I think there's, and the glasses actually can be used, so if you're trying to sell this right to your institution, for wayfinding studies, which is something I desperately want to do at Harvard because we'd have no signage, or shelf reading studies. There's lots of other things that you can do besides this kind of thing. So you kind of like, see, like the return on investment, you can look at a lot of different things about your institution, but it's not cheap, sadly.
So I'm just going to formally wrap up real quick, and then we can go do more questions. I just want to make sure that everybody knows that you know, I appreciate you guys coming, and wanted again to thank our sponsor, Franklin McGilliam Rare Books, and was very pleased to see the turnout, and I hope this was a fruitful experience for all of you. Anyway, back to the questions. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea, and I think part of what we're hoping to get out of with the collections are the story. When you say the collections are the story, then you say, well, I'm presenting this collection, or I'm presenting things from this collection, rather than, for lack of a better term, sort of an item level treatment, right, of this thing, not divorced from context, but we should divorce items from the context of our collection, unless the story we're trying to tell is the story of our collections. And I think your comment about the headline, I think we're trying to do that on some of our exhibits too. And I'm also, really, I think I'm going to come back and put my foot down. What's the call? I mean, the call number means nothing, right? So if we have limited...
You just crossed poor John.
I'm a former catalog. And what it means... Well, so what it means... So we have our curators saying, well, if we don't have that, then someone's going to come in and they're going to request this and they're not going to know what it is. But again, we have limited amount of screen of attention, and white space is king, and I feel like what we're assuming that our own internal structures and the fact that this is Summerfield D632 is somehow relevant. Again, I think it's tying it so much into our collection, and if what we're really trying to do is educate someone about the first book on frogs, or educate somebody about Caxton, or whatever we're trying to do, then our own internal historical mechanism is not that important. But anyway, so... Exhibits we do in Omeka instance, we can find that information. So it's not as if we're going to have someone come in and say, I was here 6 months ago and I found the blue book and I want to see it now, right? I mean, that's not going to happen. So anyway, that's my... say that in a second. I would say this is a generous gift of Molly Schwartzberg, but I'm not going to say it's Schwartzberg D6365, because I think that also says something very different, you know?
Yeah, but if you're pulling from 17 different collections, that's actually something that some of your visitors are going to be fascinated by and impressed by.
Mm-hmm. Disagree, but I think we can do it in a way that is textual and narrative and not a string of letters, which is our shelf mark.
If you have other questions, feel free to come up, I guess.